This is the Blood Red podcast from the Liverpool Echo, giving you the inside track on all the big talking points from Anfield.
Hello, everyone, and welcome along to the Liverpool Echo's Blood Red podcast, where we bring you the Friday fix of all things Liverpool FC ahead of this weekend's FA Cup fourth round trip to Brighton. I'm Patrick Smith, and I'm once again joined by a star-studded Echo panel. At first, we've got LFC correspondent Paul Gorst. Gorsty, how's things?
Yeah, not bad. Just looking forward to another trip to Brighton this weekend. So another long day, and let's just hope it's not as a...
You could definitely do with an apartment down there, Gorsty. Couldn't you get one in Wolverhampton as well while you're at it? We've also got Theo Squires there. Welcome back, Theo. Are you ready to do a bit of FA Cup moaning once again?
Yeah, maybe. I suppose I can't moan too much as they've got a full week going into this one again. Though Jurgen Klopp did have a little bit of a moan at his press conference about playing it at weekend with so many games in hand still to come. I'm sure we'll get to that in a bit.
Yeah, we'll definitely touch on that. And then rounding off the panel, we've got our very own women's football and all-round LFC expert, Beth Lindup. Great to have you back on the pod, Beth.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you all here. It's been a pretty interesting week for Liverpool. Relatively quiet on the pitch, but off the pitch, there's been a lot more to say, shall we stay? So let's get stuck right into that. We'll come to you, Gorsty. We're going to start the show with a bit of chat about the statement released by Spirit of Shankly on the ownership. It's safe to say across our channel, social media, almost every platform you could think of, it's divided Liverpool fans. For those who haven't read the statement, could you sort of briefly describe what Spirit of Shankly are trying to achieve and then also what you make of their statement?
Yeah, so the Spirit of Shankly are obviously Liverpool's supporters union, aren't they? And they're quite influential. And they've teamed up with the Manchester United Supporters Trust to essentially write to the government and demand stricter legislation over who's allowed to take over football clubs in England. It's something that's quite timely, given that obviously both clubs are up for sale, but I imagine, you know, clubs up and down the land, you know, certain kind of nefarious owners have been allowed to take over some community assets and it just hasn't worked out. And they're essentially just looking for stricter legislation over who is allowed to take over. And obviously, you know, we've got the issue around Newcastle United at the moment with the public investment fund of Saudi Arabia. And going back further than that, we've had Roman Abramovich take over Chelsea 20 years ago now, wasn't it? And, you know, we've seen what happened with them this year with the club itself essentially was in possession of the government, wasn't it? While Abramovich assets were seized and all that kind of stuff. So it's just a letter to the government from both supporters unions speaking on behalf of the two biggest, most well-supported clubs in England, basically just calling for, as I say, stronger measures over who's allowed to just swan into the country and you know, take over clubs, and essentially just looking out for something that is beyond more than just who's got the biggest checkbook. What I found interesting from the fallout from it was a lot of criticism towards it. And I think a lot of it is really unfair. I think a lot of it has come in and people have even accused Spirit of Shankly and MUST as being xenophobic and borderline racist with the idea behind it all. But it's nothing like that at all. It's essentially just looking out for football clubs and these huge, you know, kind of pillars of the community, whether it's in Liverpool or Manchester or, you know, Bury, Oldham, Wigan, you know, throughout the entire country. It's just about looking after who is allowed to come in and essentially ride roughshod over things. We've seen Bury go to the wall, haven't we, in recent years and you know, all that kind of stuff. So it goes beyond just merely being, you know, Premier League clubs who can spend hundreds of millions of pounds in the transfer markets. It's just looking out for football clubs in general. I think a lot of people are putting two and two together with the timing of the statement, obviously with the rumours around the Qatar ownership going on. But Spirit of Shankly actually started speaking to MUST in November, and they actually wrote to the Secretary of State in December. And it's something that I've kind of known about for a while and had to sit on while I waited for things to kind of unfold in the background. So we eventually had the story going on our site on, was it Wednesday morning? And, you know, I spoke to Alison McGovern, who's a Labour MP of Whittle South, spoke to her a few weeks back as part of the piece, and she was, you know, fully in support of what Spirit of Shankly and Manchester United Supporters Trust were looking to do. And, you know, said that, you know, Tracy Crouch's fan-led review, that there are, you know, a lot of positive elements in that, but they're just looking to try to bring it forward. And essentially just making sure that these clubs don't get taken over by people who, you know, have the wrong interest at heart, essentially. And that, you know, whether you're a Liverpool supporter in Dubai, South Africa, you know, Egbert, you know, wherever it is on the planet, that has to be a good thing, that your football club, you know, they are looking out for what is essentially right and proper. So I think some of the criticism for both Spirit of Shankly and Manchester United Supporters Trust has been heavy-handed and massively unfair, and they're essentially just looking out to make sure that they don't fall into the hands of Russian oligarchs with ties to Vladimir Putin, or, you know, venture capitalists who are only out for, you know, not interested in progressing the club. They're just looking to make a fast buck and not bother about what happens on the pitch. So, yeah, it's been an interesting few days, and I think a lot of the criticism has been unfair, and a lot of it has just been surrounding kind of people who aren't that interested in the governance of the game, and just want to see the most money spent in the transfer market, which to more and more people, it seems like that's become the end game of football fandom.
I mean, that's the point you make there, Ghost. I think the main reason the fans have a problem with it is, you know, the impression that's given that the money that Liverpool need to sort of compete in the transfer market is only available from, you know, controversial, shall we say, resources. Not all of it. I mean, there are obviously going to be some that have clean records and, you know, will be fine compared to, say, the Newcastle owners. Now, where do you think, what do you think is more important, Ghosty, getting that money in, or do you think, you know, this regulator needs to come in now before, you know, the grass is always greener with new ownership in football, isn't it, before Liverpool potentially slip down a very dangerous slope, shall we say?
Yeah, look, I mean, you're only going to look at the Newcastle ownership situation, the public investment fund of Saudi Arabia, and the Premier League are adamant that they've received assurances that it is not the, you know, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia who are in charge of that football club. But I think we all know that that is not 100% correct, don't we? And you've only got to look at they're actually changing the away kits to mimic the national team of Saudi Arabia, and just little things like that. And, you know, there are so many issues around that particular nation with the, you know, the, I mean, there's talk of, you know, beheadings of people who kind of speak out against the state, and obviously all the LGBTQ issues and so many things that, you know, if Liverpool were kind of being looked at from state ownership, then organisations like the Spirit of Shankly and the recently appointed LFC Supporters Board are going to be thrust into the deep end, and they're going to have the work cut out for them to essentially, you know, kind of stand up for what a lot of fans believe is right and proper. And it's what I've seen a lot recently in the last couple of days is people trying to have a go at the Spirit of Shankly for supposedly working with a Conservative government, or asking for help from the Conservative government. Now, we know, you know, Liverpool as a city is traditionally left-leaning, isn't it, and all that kind of stuff. But I think a lot of that is just being willfully overlooking the situation, or just, you know, deliberately misunderstanding the situation. They are the government, whether we like it or not, and they're the only ones who are able to implement change via legislation. So I'm not too sure who the Spirit of Shankly are meant to be working with to bring in these kind of laws and things around ownership of football clubs. But essentially, it is just looking to make sure that there's perhaps, you know, more stricter governance over who is allowed to own football clubs in England, and perhaps the horse is bolted on it to an extent, but it doesn't mean that you should completely give up if you do feel that it's right. And, you know, you look at Spirit of Shankly's track record in recent history. They obviously spoke out against the £77 tickets, didn't he? What was that, 6 years ago? The Super League fallout. They managed to speak about the getting away tickets capped at £30. So they've done a lot of good. You know, the trademark of Liverpool that FSG wanted to take, and the furlough scheme and all that kind of stuff. So they are essentially looking out for what you would suggest is right and proper as a football fan. So, you know, fair play to them. For the criticism that they've been coming in for, I think has been really poor, I think.
Yeah, a lot of it is really unfair. I mean, you know, you might make the point there of people saying, oh, they're getting into bed with the Tories. I mean, so they have to. They are the government that's in state at the moment. You can't really do anything about that. But anyway, we'll wrap that up there, though, Gorsty. Very interesting stuff. So there'll be more developments across maybe next week on that one.
The Blood Red Podcast from the Liverpool Echo.
But let's get back to on-the-pitch news then, Theo. We'll come to you. Young Stefan Bajcetic, we've been talking about him a lot on podcast recently since I've been hosting. He's come up every week. Massive long-term deal for him. Really good news for him as a player. And do you think he is Liverpool's future in the number six role?
Potentially, yeah. It's like, we know Liverpool are planning this midfield revamp at some point in this year. And it's one where he could be a long-term solution as the number six. But as Jurgen Klopp keeps reminding everyone, they've got to be careful with him because he is still a teenager. Like, you don't want him to, or to put all your eggs on focusing on him as this number six, and then he breaks down with injury or he's not the same player. Like, we've seen so many youngsters have shown early promise and not been able to kick on. You don't want to put the pressure on his shoulders. But so far, so good. He deserved his chance against Chelsea last week for that first Premier League start. We spoke to him in the mix zone after the game and he came across really well. A bit shy, as you'd expect for an 18-year-old facing the journalists for the first time in a mix zone, but he spoke well and he seems really down to earth. And he's a player that I think is very likeable. And I think fans are getting that vibe off him as well. He's someone that you want to see doing well in this team. Realistically, a normal Liverpool season, he's not getting anywhere near a starting 11. Like, when players are on form and Liverpool are doing well, they wouldn't have needed to turn to him just yet. And it's just because of circumstances with Fabinho dropping off, Henderson dropping off, that he's got this opportunity. But Klopp said himself, I don't think the door was even open, and yet he stormed straight through it. It's just as well because he is taking these opportunities. And while I don't think we're going to see the absolute best of him week on week for the rest of the season, and it'll be a big ask to turn to him for the next 6 months as Liverpool try and get into Champions League places, it's still a very good option to have. We just need to look at, say, Curtis Jones, Harvey Elliott, where they get all that excitement when they come through at 18, 17, and then there's that little bit of drop-off. Players struggle for consistency because they're still young. He's still a teenager playing a men's game. It will take him a while to fully come to terms with that. I'm sure he's still got some developing and some growth to do. But he said this in the mix zone to us as well, that he's just focused on improving and getting the minutes where he can. But it's good for Liverpool. It's another youth player they've got tied down for the foreseeable. And whatever they spend in the summer on new midfielders, whoever they might be, it's good to have some of their own there as well. We're saving millions. Like, this is a player who cost them less than 250 grand. It's about getting that blend right. And while we don't know what they can do in the transfer market, how much they've got, and we certainly don't think they've got anything to go and do it now, in the next week or so, as Jurgen Klopp said, at least they've got half of it right with the players coming through the academy.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. Maybe perhaps this contract hints at players who are running out of contracts, such as Cade, Oxlade, Chamberlain, Milner, may not be getting their extensions. Who knows on that? But it's good to see Bajcetic getting that contract and hopefully see him a bit more in the starting team, because I think coinciding with Fabinho's sort of dip in form, why not give him the chance? But there's good to have plenty of options in midfield. Beth, you've been sitting there very patiently. We're going to bring you in now then, talking about these options Liverpool could have returning soon from injury as well, not just in midfield. Klopp in his press conference today hinting at the returns of Van Dijk, Diogo Jota, Luis Diaz, Roberto Firmino in a couple of weeks' time. I mean, they're going to be some massive returns, aren't they? Particularly Van Dijk and Jota, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, obviously, a couple of years ago when Liverpool had that real drop-off, when obviously they had the massive defensive crisis and they had all of the senior centre-backs out, and obviously Nat Phillips and Rhys Williams came in. At that time, it felt like everyone was sort of, they gave Liverpool a little bit of grace because of the mitigating circumstances. But I think because the injuries have been sort of spread across the squad in various positions, I don't necessarily think that's something that people have, you know, been fair to Liverpool about really this season, because they have missed a lot of key players. For me, I think Jota and Diaz in particular are the biggest ones. I think, you know, that game against Chelsea at the weekend was crying out for just a moment of individual brilliance. And we've seen, especially the likes of Luis Diaz, produce those moments time and time again. You know, you go back to the Crystal Palace game when he just takes on 3-4 players and scores an absolute stunner. And he did it against Tottenham last season too. So that will be a huge, huge boost for Liverpool when they come back and they're fit. And even Van Dijk, who, you know, arguably has had a pretty poor season by his own standards, I think the more options Liverpool can have, the better. And I think if you look at the Brighton game a couple of weeks ago, and Matip looked a little bit out of his depth, and just having, you know, those leaders in the team back within the squad, you know, it can only be a good thing for Liverpool going forward.
Yeah, a couple of weeks, he said, I think, for Van Dijk, Jota and Firmino, and then Diaz a little bit longer, he should be. But you mentioned there, Beth, I mean, I'll stay with you. I mean, you mentioned Nat Phillips. It looks like he might be on the way out. Reece Williams has been recalled from his loan at Blackpool. I mean, do you think now is the time maybe to let Nat go?
Yeah, I think for his sake, you know, he doesn't owe the club anything at all. He's been such a good servant, and you know, he's not the sort of player to have a big ego. He could have quite easily, after that run when he helped Liverpool get the top four, sort of demanded more playing time, or you know, not given his all. And you can't question any of his commitment over the past few seasons. He's been a brilliant player, and I think if the right move it comes up for him, then he should absolutely be allowed to go. I think Klopp alluded to it earlier this morning. I don't think the club would stand in the way of letting him leave, especially with Virgil, you know, potentially coming back in a couple of weeks' time. He's a player who has the quality to be playing, I'd say, at probably the lower levels in the Premier League, certainly, and deserves to be playing week in, week out. He doesn't deserve to be sat on the bench, really. So, yeah, I think if the right club becomes available and comes in for him, then I wouldn't be surprised to see him go.
Yeah, definitely. It wouldn't surprise me if a few clubs had already put offers on the table, to be honest. I mean, he's clearly someone who can definitely play in that lower half of the table. But that's enough about outgoings. We've got to talk about some transfer rumours, as it is the January window. I mean, Klopp's made it pretty clear, Gorsty, that he doesn't want to sign anyone. But we're going to talk about some rumours anyway. And where better to start than with Jude Bellingham? There's been a few flirtations this week, as said by Theo before we came live on this podcast. I mean, he's really, really hinting at a transfer. There's been apparently some talks held this week. You know, do you think there's any possibility of this happening in the summer still, or Liverpool sort of in danger of perhaps losing into Real Madrid?
I think Liverpool are going to have to qualify for the Champions League for it to be a real credible prospect. I mean, he's only 19, but surely a player of his quality is going to be wanting to play in the Champions League. But not so much that, it's the fact that Liverpool, in the FSG-imposed self-sustainable model, they're going to need that Champions League money to be able to afford Bellingham, I think. He's going to be costing a club record fee, isn't he? And that's still, despite what some people think Darwin Nunez was brought in for, it's still Virgil van Dijk, 75 million in January of, was it 2018? So you'd imagine Bellingham's going to cost around about 100 million mark. Now, might be a few little ways of getting around that in terms of the instalments and how kind of creative Liverpool can be that way. And we've seen that with the Nunez fee. You know, it's £21 million worth of instalments. A lot of it is appearance-based, so Liverpool expect them to at least match £75 million that they paid for Van Dijk. But then around, you know, winning the Premier League and Champions League and all that kind of stuff, that's an extra £10 million on top of that. So maybe they could do something similar with Bellingham if he does have his heart set on moving to Liverpool. But I just know how important the Champions League money is to Liverpool. So given that the way that they run, I just couldn't see them getting Bellingham if they don't have the Champions League. Now, all that could change in a few months' time with the external investment and all that kind of stuff. And that's why it becomes a little bit difficult to predict what's going to happen in a few months down the line. You know, speaking to people behind the scenes and stuff, spinning plates seems to be the phrase that is being used. And I think Liverpool know that they need more than the one central midfielder, and Jude Bellingham, for all his qualities, is not going to instantly fix Liverpool overnight. I think they're going to need two, maybe even three. When you think of the situation around Naby Keita, Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain looks like he might leave. He might be keeping James Milner on, but you know, even now at 37, and he's pretty much played most of the season at right back, I think he's going to be featuring even less next season. So there's a lot to resolve there, you know, at Liverpool. And if they've only got X amount of money to play with, and they might not be in the Champions League, then it all becomes a little bit of a worry. I'd love to see him at Liverpool because he's a fantastic player, and I think he could be someone who'd play in the midfield for the best part of 15 years. But we'll see. Certainly, they're not going to be getting him this month. I think we already knew that, didn't we? But there are a few things for Liverpool to work with. Obviously, he's got a good relationship with Trent and Jordan Henderson. And Klopp's got plenty of contacts at Dortmund. And Dortmund have even said, haven't they, you know, if they're going to be forced into a sale and they'd like him to join Liverpool over anyone else. Real Madrid have recently signed Tchouaméni, and Camavinga's just kind of starting to come of age a little bit there as well. So perhaps they're not as in need of a central midfielder as Liverpool are. I think a lot of clubs last summer signed centre mid, so they might not be in as much need as Liverpool are as well. So there are a few things that Liverpool do have going for them in this pursuit, but I guess we'll have to see this summer whether they have done enough to bring him in on what would be a bit of a blockbuster deal, wouldn't it?
Don't know about you guys, but I'm a bit sick of the merry-go-round on it, because it seems like every week it's Liverpool are leading the chase, then Real Madrid are leading the chase, and then Man City are leading the chase. And it's just this vicious cycle where it's one team after the other, and then they feel like they're going to miss out. They reckon someone else is leading it. And it's just endless speculation. And obviously, he's going to be this generational talent that everyone wants to get their hands on. There is going to be all this talk. But the report, I think, was it from Neil Jones for Goal this week, was, well, Bellingham's not decided yet. The camp hasn't decided that yet, or at least they're not making it public if they have behind the scenes. So for all this speculation about talks and that, it is seemingly still very much up in the air. He must be such a mature kid to not be distracted by this. Like, they had the Bundesliga return last week. Dortmund won. He scored and he got an assist, and that shows his talent as well. But then it's one where so many things can come into it. Like, what is important for Jude Bellingham? Like, does he want to just go straight to, say, a Real Madrid, be winning La Liga titles, be in the Champions League year after year? Or is it, oh, I want to work for Jurgen Klopp? There's so much that come into play. We talk about the Champions League and the finances involved there. Well, we've got the Champions League expansion in a couple of years. So realistically, if Liverpool miss out this year, it could only be 1 year out of the Champions League, because England will presumably get five places if the teams keep performing in Europe. And you just got to look at Liverpool, how they've approached this. They've clearly put Bellingham as their first choice target. He's the reason why they're waiting, why they've not gone for any other midfielders, and why they're perhaps keeping these funds back. But to go through all of that and then risk missing out on him just because they didn't perhaps see that they couldn't make Champions League, like, you'd imagine there's going to be some finances back there for them to be able to feel that they can compete with a Real Madrid and Man City for a signature. But there's just so much to come into play here. But then, as Gorsty says, it's not just one player, is it? They need more than that in midfield. I think it was interesting when Klopp said that signing Gakpo in January would impact what else they could do. It seems like they've had talks there behind the scenes about knock-on effect for future transfers, and that'll come into play in the summer. But Liverpool will need a good few players here, not just in midfield. And it's one where, well, they're having a pretty poor season. Klopp said when they signed Gakpo, he wanted a player who was happy to push the train again rather than just jump on the moving train. If Bellingham's up for that, the challenge, happy days. If not, who knows where they turn next. Otherwise, it's a big ask. You're going to, Jude, can you take a bad team and make it better?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, all that from it all that frustrates me is that his price is just going to keep spiking, isn't it? Because, you know, you look at other clubs bidding in for him. I mean, his price tag was 130 odd million in the summer. It's going to be a lot more now, isn't it? I mean, you know, he's going to be maybe even towards the 200 million mark if you're being realistic. I mean, but also, Beth, the boys spoke there about a need for another midfielder or two at least. One that's been rumoured this week is Mason Mount, who apparently, I say it's a rumour, is going to be allowed to leave Chelsea. Should Liverpool be going in for him in that midfield role, maybe in a more advanced sort of, you know, 8/10 role, or do you think it's one they should potentially avoid?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. It's sort of one of those you think, is it genuine, or is that sort of the agent trying to wangle a better deal for a new contract at Chelsea? Who knows? But yeah, I mean, obviously, it sort of shows how fickle football is, really, doesn't it? Because a couple of years ago, Mason Mount was the best thing since sliced bread, helped Chelsea to the Champions League. And then if you go on social media this season, Chelsea fans are giving him an awful lot of stick for some of his performances. And I think, you know, he would probably admit himself, his form has dipped a little bit. He's not sort of lived up to the heights of a couple of years ago. But he's a player that I think could do really well, actually, at Liverpool and under Jurgen Klopp. And I think, you know, it's really important. We've got some younger midfielders coming through, and then we've obviously got the, you know, players like Naby Keita are getting a little bit older, obviously James Milner 37, and you don't really have that midfielder who's in the prime, who's at that prime age, 24, 25, 26. And I think obviously Mason Mount is 24, I think. So obviously Premier League proven, plenty of experience under his belt. So he's the sort of profile of a player, I think, that could come in, and if he were to sort of refine his form under Jurgen Klopp at Liverpool, could potentially be a be a really exciting option.
The Blood Red Podcast from the Liverpool Echo.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he's a player who's pretty divisive. You know, some people love him, some people hate him, particularly when he plays for England. He definitely stirs opinions, shall we say. But I'll stay with you, Beth, speaking of Chelsea, because you are our own in-house women's football expert. Now, it's been a pretty controversial week, hasn't it, to put it lightly, in the WSL. Liverpool against Chelsea being called off after 6 minutes. A Liverpool player subsequently picked up an injury from that match. I mean, you know, tell us a bit about what happened there and sort of the fallout from it all, because it's pretty shocking stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, it's shambolic, really, that it's happening in the top flight of the women's game. You know, there'll be people who argue that postponements and things like that happen in the lower leagues, you know, in the men's side of things, which is absolutely true. But I think the whole way the situation was handled was appalling, really. I think for anyone who doesn't know, Liverpool travelled down to Chelsea for a Women's Super League meeting with at King's Meadow, Chelsea's home ground. And the day before, actually, Tottenham's game over on the other side of London had been called off because of a frozen pitch. And the decision was obviously made for Chelsea to leave it till the morning of the match. So it was 9:30, I think it was. The game was due to kick off at 12:30. There was a pitch inspection. The pitch was deemed to be unplayable. The FA have subsequently said that then they decided they put the heaters and the pitch covers on for a little bit and hoped that things got better. And then there was a subsequent pitch inspection about, you know, half an hour before the warm-up, at which point the pitch was deemed to be playable. But it obviously wasn't the case. There were parts you could see quite clearly, even in the warm-up, down the sides of the pitch, players were slipping over. It was just so icy. And then the game kicks off, and after less than 6 minutes, the referee called the two captains together and abandoned play, really. And yeah, it was shocking. And I think, you know, the fallout from it, a lot of people have called for undersoil heating or, you know, the opportunity for female players to play more at the men's grounds as well. But I think the most important thing going forward is that, you know, things aren't going to change overnight. They're not, all of these clubs aren't going to get undersoil heating overnight. It's going to be a long process if it does indeed happen. So I think the crucial thing is just forward planning and taking into consideration player safety, because, you know, after Liverpool's game in the Conti Cup midweek, Matt Beard confirmed that Shanice van der Sanden had slipped during the warm-up at Chelsea and felt a twinge in her knee. So she's out for, I'm not quite sure how long now, but I think they're assessing her ahead of this weekend's game. But it just shows you how dangerous it was. There's been so many serious injuries in the WSL this season. So it was a reckless decision, really, to allow that game to go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's bad enough sort of calling it off on the morning of the game, let alone 6 minutes into the match. I mean, it's, you know, embarrassing to think of, really, from the officiating side of that. I mean, you look as well that Liverpool are playing Chelsea at Anfield. So Stamford Bridge was vacant that weekend. You know, why couldn't they play the game there? Not only for practical reasons, but also to help grow the women's game. I mean, yeah, baffling all around. I'm sure there'll be further developments on that, because it's truly, truly shocking in the top flight of women's football that that's still allowed to happen. But anyway, let's return back to the men's game. Gorsty, I mean, I was saying before, you're going to need to get an apartment down in Brighton, seeing the amount of times Liverpool have been playing them there. Now, the last time was obviously, in my opinion, the worst Liverpool performance I've seen under Jurgen Klopp. I don't think that's that dramatic a statement to make. Do you think it'll be any different this time round?
It can't be as bad, surely. We were talking kind of in Brighton's press room after that game. We were looking at the kind of really poor days of Jurgen Klopp's reign, and you know, every one of them was kind of explainable to an extent, except for that one. You know, of course, they had injuries to a few players and whatever else, but it's still a strong team that took to the pitch that Saturday afternoon. But it's just kind of exposed all the problems that Liverpool have had all season. There was no energy in the press, and the midfield were getting bypassed too often, and the defence were too easy to get at. And then in possession themselves, they were absolutely fraught. He just kept giving it away and just couldn't get hold of it. And Brighton won't have an easier home game all season, which is shocking, really. So it can't be that bad. They've kept two clean sheets since, haven't they? Looked a little bit more solid, if not particularly free-flowing going forward, something Klopp spoke about before in his press conference. You know, there weren't too many huge chances in that win against Wolves. It took a Harvey Elliott wonder goal to win it. And then against Chelsea at home on last Saturday, you know, not a chance to write home about, was there? Cody Gakpo fired one over early on. seems to be the only one I can think of off the top of my head. So while they have tightened up, closed spaces, become a little bit more compact, pressed a little bit better, they've certainly not come any closer to developing a little bit of a spark in the final third. And, you know, that's understandable to an extent when they've got no Firmino, Jota or Diaz. Nunes, of course, missed Brighton the last time, didn't he? And Gakpo's only just come into the team. He's still getting used to the rigours of Premier League football. So there are plenty of reasons for why Liverpool aren't firing on all cylinders in the final third. It's not really excuse-making. It's just more of an explanation. But, you know, now that they have kind of got to grips a little bit more over how to tighten up defensively, you hope that they're going to be a little bit more progressive on the front foot going forward, starting with Brighton on Sunday afternoon, because it can't be as bad as the other week, can it? Because that really was an idea of the season.
Yeah, I mean, surely not. Theo Klopp was talking in his presser today. I think Gorsty touched on it there, like how impressed he is with the defensive improvements since then. I mean, it is two clean sheets. Do you think, you know, we can take any significance from that? I mean, Chelsea didn't exactly pose much of a goal threat, and as Wolves as well, wasn't it? Not exactly dangerous sides. I mean, do you think Liverpool have improved defensively, or do you think it's just been two fortunate matches?
Maybe a mixture, to be honest. It's one where Klopp said you have to take the little steps, and that's what Liverpool have done. They've made the little steps. They have got these two clean sheets. But if not for VAR, they'd have conceded in the first 5 minutes against Chelsea, and then they could have been in for a very long afternoon. There's a few chances that Chelsea would perhaps think they should have done a bit better with in the second half especially. But there was some resilience there from Liverpool. They dug in, and it's not perfect, but at least they haven't been completely outplayed. Like Klopp said, that Brighton game was the worst, and thank God that he's not changed his mind since then, because that means Liverpool have improved slightly. But you need them to make a lot more of these little steps, because they were a long way off where you want them to be and where they'll want to be. I think we've already got a settled strong back four at the moment. Seems like Joe Gomez is edged out, Joel Matip, and the rest of it picks itself. So you'd like to think they can have this blossoming partnerships there, and it can slowly start to piece together. But I think it's only looked as an improvement because of how bad it was in the first place, especially against Brighton. You can say Brentford as well, because in a normal season, when Liverpool are at their best, if they don't have those, we're looking back at Chelsea so much more worse, because Liverpool didn't really threaten much and they weren't at their best at all. Chelsea were all over them for the majority of that game, and they just weren't a very good team either. But you say you could put these steps together, who knows, maybe we'll see a revival from Liverpool at some point. Clean sheets at least give them confidence, and if you don't concede, it only takes one goal to get the win. We saw that in the Wolves replay. As long as it's not 3-0 and Liverpool can start well, can hopefully keep another clean sheet, make it three in a row, it's another little step on the way to what will hopefully be a revival second half of the season.
Yeah, fair play to Joe Gomez as well. I mean, I'm really hoping that he can get a bit of form put together, and, you know, a few clean sheets in a row isn't going to do any harm to that one, is it? But Beth, I'll come to you first. I'll come to all of you on this, though. I mean, the significance of the FA Cup is always going to be a talking point on the match days. Now, you know, we were speaking before the third round clash with Wolves that maybe it wasn't a priority for some certain fans. I'm sure if Ian Doyle was here, he'd be shouting over me, telling me the FA Cup is the be-all and end-all. But do you think this can now be an important part of Liverpool's season, Beth? I mean, as top four seems to slip away, I don't really want to say that, but could the cup have more significance now?
I think so. I think it's been, by all accounts, a pretty joyless season, really, hasn't it? So, you know, a decent cup run, especially when you look at some of the games last season, you know, especially that semi-final with Manchester City. It was a fantastic day and a real sort of boost for Liverpool toward the back end of the season. So I definitely think, especially, you know, the nature of this game this weekend, obviously they've had a week to prepare for it. I think it'd be maybe a slightly different story if it had been sandwiched in midweek, and, you know, it was maybe an extra game that they didn't need to play. But, you know, they've had a full week to recover, a full week to prepare, and obviously then have, you know, a little bit of time before the next game in the Premier League as well. So yeah, I think, I imagine they'll come out as strong as they possibly can, and yeah, it'd be a good way to sort of banish the January blues a little bit, I think.
Yeah, Gorsty, what's your take on it? Are you looking forward to another potential replay, another match with Brighton?
No, not particularly, no. I think I mean, every time Liverpool play Brighton and something Klopp touched on today in his press conference, it's always been tough. You know, even when Liverpool were absolutely flying, you know, three years ago, and last year, it's always tough. So going there again after such a resounding beating at a time when you're struggling for confidence and you've got so many injuries, probably the last thing Klopp wanted. So it's going to be a difficult one. But he kind of said something today that, you know, being holders doesn't really mean a whole lot. But what it does know is, or what it does give you is the knowledge that, you know, what it feels like when you're in the final and, you know, kind of the experience of that is something that you can cling to when you're kind of looking to motivate yourself to go further and further in the competition. So we're still early doors, aren't we, in the FA Cup? There's only the fourth round, but they can look to, like Beth says, that semi-final day at Wembley last season against Manchester City, which was just one of the outstanding days of the season. And then, of course, they went on to win it a few weeks later against Chelsea. So, you know, those sorts of memories can hold them in good stead when they're in these cup competitions. But saying that, I still think, obviously, top four will be the override name for this season. And, you know, a small matter of Real Madrid to come in, what is it, just over 3 weeks. So still a lot to play for Liverpool this season. The FA Cup's probably the bottom of the three priorities, if you like. But you just don't want to see them bowing out meekly to, you know, on the wrong end of another hiding at Brighton, do you?
Yeah, no, we absolutely don't. We don't really want to see a replay again, do we, Theo? I mean, you're someone who, much like me, I'm sure, hates the thought of replays. I mean, just quickly, do you think Liverpool's priority should be elsewhere, or would you be prioritising the FA Cup?
Probably should be elsewhere. Like, the focus has to be getting in the top four and going far in the Champions League. But also in that, we know how far off the top four they are at the moment. And I'm sure quite a few of us are pessimistic about that Real Madrid game. They could easily be out of the Champions League within a few weeks. And in that situation, it's like, God, I wish we still had the FA Cup to play for. A nice little cup run, chance of silverware. It's one where the game coming now, it's fine. It's out of the weekend. They've had a week to prepare for it. They can go full strength, no issues there. Hopefully putting an improved performance to put the Brighton Demons to bed, build a bit of momentum and make it what would be three-game unbeaten run. Ooh, dizzying heights. But then where you see where the next rounds come, and it's just not feasible really for Liverpool to stay in this competition any longer if they want to be at their best. Like, I think the fifth round would come in between Palace and United at the end of Feb. And then if you've got into the quarterfinals, that's the same day as the Fulham game and the last game before the international break. February already looks pretty vile for Liverpool, where it's, Wolves, Everton, Newcastle, Madrid, Palace, United, Bournemouth, Madrid, Fulham. If you put in two FA Cup games in there as well, along with potentially two postponed Premier League games against Wolves and Chelsea, like Klopp's already said today, why aren't we playing these rearranged games already? We've had these midweeks free in January. And got these cup games where they're taking up weekends. They could have had these two league games done and dusted, and they haven't. And when they're picking up these injuries as well, it gets even more painful, like bodies dropping down, and you've got to go again. But that's tomorrow's problem. Today, they've had a 4 week to train. They haven't seemed to have any new injury problems, and they can go again and build momentum. But they get through, it might not be the prettiest thing in a few weeks' time.
The Blood Red Podcast from the Liverpool Echo.
Yeah, I think we've all been very safe there and said that the priority should be elsewhere. So if Liverpool do lose tomorrow, we can all look very smart and say, well, we told you so. But on that then, let's pick
our team. I'd be amazed if they lose tomorrow, Pat.
Oh, well, don't give away your prediction just yet, Theo. We'll come round to that, I'm sure. Sunday then, sorry, I'm getting confused. It's been a very long day, shall we say. Anyway, let's move on to our team selectors. Beth, we'll come to you first. I mean, Coivin Kelleher has been the cup keeper, but Jürgen Klopp's trusted Alisson Becker in the FA Cup so far this season, so we expect Alisson will play in goal. The back four, though, is probably going to be one of the most interesting topics in this team selector. Who are you going to choose in yours?
Yeah, I'm a bit conflicted, really, because, you know, as Theo said, it was good to sort of see a little bit of a partnership developing between Konate and Joe Gomez, but then you look back at that Brighton game a couple of weeks ago and Matoma had Trent on toast for the majority of the game. So it's a question of, do you move Joe Gomez across to right back and bring Matip in? But then Matip had a horror show at Brighton as well. So I'm going to go with Trent right back, Gomez and Konate, and Robertson left back.
Gusty, how about yourself? I mean, you know, Joel Matip's come under a bit of heat recently. Is there any shout for him coming back in, or are you going to go similar to Beth?
No, I am going to stick with the guns, because I think it was a little bit of a kick up the backside to the likes of Fabinho and Henderson and Matip last week being left out. You know, your place is under threat now, and you can't just go putting in the kind of performances you did at Brighton and expect to be playing next week. So, yeah, Konate, Gomez, bringing Trent back in, because Liverpool have got absolutely no creativity without him in the team. So he starts, and Robertson on the left.
Theo, if you want to talk us through your back four, and then want to talk into your midfield as well.
Exact same back four. I think it makes sense to have your first choice when you've got this week to prepare for it and to try and, well, I suppose they've got a couple of clean sheets just to build on it, because we know Trent's going to stay first choice. And I think it was injury that kept him out the start 11 last week. Midfield, it's a difficult one. I wish I hadn't been come to first here, so then I could just copy someone else.
We can come back to you if you want there.
I'll brave it. It's one where you're going to have to turn back to Fabinho and Henderson at some point. You've got to give them games and hope they can find form. But you don't want it to be back at Brighton after the horror show. You want to have them a few weeks out first and have them fighting for the places. So I think I'll go Pesetic as the number six. He's doing well, high on confidence after the contract. And it might just be a case of going again with Cater and Thiago. It's a trio that have done reasonably well. I know Thiago's played a lot of football, and if he drops out, you can maybe make a claim for Milner, who I think has done really well since coming back from injury, or Oxlade-Chamberlain. But I don't see too many reasons to change it, so we'll stick with the three that started against Chelsea and Wolves.
I mean, Beth, it's nice having these options to choose from, isn't it? Are you going to align yourself similarly with Theo, or are you going to put maybe one more attacking midfielder in there?
I'm going to cop out and do exactly what Theo suggested and go with exactly the same as him. Yeah, Pesetic in the six, and then Thiago and Cater.
Gusty, how about yourself?
Yeah, I'm thinking of keeping it the same, actually, because none of them have done anything to be dropped, really. Cater's still finding his feet, hasn't he? He's only started two games now, so let's keep him in the team. Thiago, I think, has been vastly improved since Brighton. And Bacicic, fair play to him. He's in there on merit at the moment, isn't he? So I'm keeping it as it is.
I'll stick with you then, Ghost, if you want to talk through the front three. Maybe there's a bit more chance for diversity between your choices here.
Yeah, I mean, the only call is whether to go with Nunes on the left or Gakpo on the left, really. And I'm still not sure what we're seeing in Cody Gakpo. I think he's used to playing off the left. So I think leading the line in a different position for Liverpool at a time when they're in such a difficult period is tough. Probably unfair, so I'll go with Nunes down the middle and Gakpo off the left, and see how that pans out.
Theo, how about yourself? You're not going to give Harvey Elliott a chance? I mean, the man who's played in the front line recently definitely showed a much more promising skill set, I think, in an attacking role than a midfield role. Would you give him a shot, or are you going to go similar to Gusty?
Do you want to be the man that tells Mohamed Salah you're dropping him after a full week of trading without the midweek game?
He played pretty well on the left wing against Wolves, I think it was, Harvey Elliott, didn't he?
Did an all right, he was on the right against Wolves, wasn't he?
I mean, he's on the left at times. I remember him popping up there.
He was on the left against Chelsea, and he didn't do much. He didn't really suit him. He looks a lot better on the right-hand side. So this one where if you wanted to rotate it, you could give Salah a rest and put him on the right. But I think you just go for the strongest three here. Like, we've had Klopp offer the update on Jota and Firmino and say in a few weeks they'll be back. But you don't know how fit they're going to be for those games against the likes of Real Madrid, whether they'll be able to start games or not. So in that case, you just want your strongest available three playing games together and getting a relationship going. So long we've seen Mane, Salah and Firmino as this untouchable front three that are just in sync for so long. And it's strange seeing a Liverpool attack that doesn't have that, because they are new teammates. But they need games and they need something to click so they can get the goals flowing. And yeah, I'd go with Gakpo on the left because, four games in, he hasn't really shown much, but he's had to do three of them up front, which isn't his favourite position. And it's in a struggling team. Let's see him in his best position. Like when he was playing well for the Netherlands at the World Cup or for PSV, it's been from the left-hand side. When he was less effectual for the Dutch, it was when he was playing up front as this number nine. He wants to be on the left. He's a winger. Let's play to his strengths, have him there and let Captain Chaos run supreme down the middle and see if that can knock Brighton about a bit and make revenge for that 3-0 defeat a few weeks ago.
Yeah, Beth, what do you make of Gakpo? And I don't want to be too critical of him. Obviously, it's going to take some time to adapt. He's had four games now. He hasn't scored yet. Do you think he could maybe benefit from coming on as a substitute? Or would you keep starting him in the hope that, you know, something will click with him and Darwin?
Yeah, I would start him. I think it'd be good to, especially while Jota and Diaz are still out for a little while longer, to maybe build a little bit of a rapport between him and Nunes. So yeah, I'd play him on the left. I've not been massively impressed with him up front, albeit in a really poor team. So, you know, you can't judge him too early. But yeah, I'd put him on the left, Darwin through the middle and Mo on the right.
Yeah, I think that probably is the right call. It'd be nice to see Darwin Nunes back starting as well. Captain Chaos, nicely dubbed there by Theo. Anyway, we'll round off the show then with our match predictions. Gorsty, we'll come to you first. I mean, this one could go anywhere. I'm sure it's not going to be the most optimistic of our predictions this season, but what are you going to call?
No, I suppose a lot of it depends on how De Zerbi approaches it. Does he make changes himself? They've already knocked Arsenal out the Carabao Cup. They might be viewing Liverpool as another big scalp. I'm going to go with a 2-2 draw.
A buzzing for another replay then, Gorsty. You just can't get enough of Brighton at the moment, can you? Theo, are you going to hope for a replay?
I think when we were doing league predictions, I said an optimistic draw. So I have to go for an optimistic draw again. So I mean, I'm not going to go 2-0. I'll go 1-0 because I don't think Liverpool score many at the moment.
I think if there's another FA Cup replay, Jurgen Klopp is surely going to explode. Beth, do you have anything different or are you going to make it a hat-trick of draws?
I'm going to be positive and go 2-1 Liverpool just because I can't bear the thought of another replay. So yeah, let's hope.
Yeah, let's hope and be positive. I think, you know, either way Liverpool go, all guns blazing, go for it. Or not be happy to lose because you're never going to be happy to lose. But I don't think it's the absolute end of the world if it does go slightly wrong down at Brighton for everyone. But we'll wrap the show up there. Thank you for joining us, everyone watching and listening along. And of course, a huge thank you to Paul Gorse, Theo Squires and Beth Lindup for joining me today. Make sure, everyone, that you're sticking around on the Blood Red channel for all the build-up and post-match reaction to Liverpool's clash with Brighton tomorrow, including Jurgen Klopp's press conference. And of course, stay up to date with the Liverpool Echo websites and socials to get all the action on there. But from myself, Patrick Smith, Paul Gorse, Theo Squires and Beth Lindup, thank you very much for joining us. We'll catch you next time on the Blood Red Podcast.
You've been listening to the Blood Red Podcast from the Liverpool Echo.